Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, August 31st. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the hospital's minimally invasive gynecologic surgery program, led by doctors Anouk Lambers and Siobhan Hayden. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Well, it's been about 6 months since COVID-19 seared its way into our consciousness. And we've learned a lot since then, but there's a lot we don't know. And joining us for an update today is virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He's ready to take your questions about the coronavirus. We anticipate a lot of calls, so call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager's research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. If you have a question about coronavirus or virology in general, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll check the email bag sometime in the program. But once again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, welcome back, sir. How are you?
Great to be here, Ray. I hope that you and your family are well and healthy.
And same to you. Now, you know, it's been a month or two or three, I don't know, since you've been on. And really, I'm sure we have learned a lot. And you'll tell us about what we've learned about coronavirus and this COVID-19. But it seems that the same complaint that I had that we talked about the last several times you were on, still a thing. And in that we hear varying bits of news that contradict each other all the time. What is the state of the art? What do we know now that we didn't know about this particular coronavirus and COVID-19 that we didn't know when you were on the last time?
Right. So I think you hit the nail on the head. What this is really is people need to remember it's, you know, 6 months, like you said at the beginning of the show, 6 months since it started. And the knowledge and science are evolving along with this pandemic. So with time, we're gaining more information. And part of that is, and this is the nature of science, the more evidence we get, the more information we get, the information can change. So mask, no mask, droplet versus aerosol. So it is, with the exposure that we, in the news and social media, we get with this virus, rightfully so, it does seem to be conflicting within the first, you know, a week, a day, or a month. So it can be a challenge to keep up to date. I think what the data really is now is in terms of the disease itself, it seems like clinicians have a better way to diagnose and treat the disease. And we've seen the death rates fall, fortunately, because of this. And we're starting to learn more about how our body responds to this virus. And that's going to help us in long term in developing a vaccine.
You know, it occurs to me that in some ways, social media is like a virus in that it propagates itself and does strange things that you can't predict. As a scientist, does it drive you mad at times to find half-baked information or partial information turn into huge things via social media?
For me, it's a range of emotions. I think first, what my opinion is, a lot of it is concern. I mean, when this first arose, people were rightfully concerned. No one, even scientists, were concerned, what is this new virus? What do we have to do to beat it? How deadly is it? So I think whenever there's a sense of urgency or even fear, it does drive a lot of this online and a lot of misinformation. What I have found over the months and coming on your show with the questions that we've gotten, the public seems more informed. So I'm encouraged that people are looking for the right sources of information. The misinformation that we saw early on kind of some quackery and other things that didn't quite work and that this was a hoax, I think that's a little lessened, particularly in this area. And in my mind, it seems more people are becoming more aware of what this virus is and how we can prevent its spread.
But what don't we know? In other words, you just mentioned, well, there's the aerosol and then there's the droplets. And what do we know about the transmission of this that we didn't know several months ago.
Right. So early on, when it was identified as a coronavirus, scientists and clinicians relied on the information we had on those viruses at the time. So if most respiratory viruses, the main routes are through droplets and then through fomites or touch contact. So that's why you saw the initial recommendations by the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control for hand washing, hand hygiene. So in case there was a chance that the object you touched was contaminated, particularly if you were in a situation where someone, a loved one or a coworker was sick, that you could pick up the virus on your hands. And if you touched your nose or eyes, you could transmit the virus to yourself and become sick from that. But far the far more likely way to get sick was through droplets, so coughing and sneezing. So when clinicians and scientists first were trying to figure out what are the major symptoms of this disease, people were showing, as a respiratory virus would do, coughing, sneezing. And those droplets, you know, are expelled anywhere from 3 to 6 feet. And that's what drove the information to say maintain social distancing of 6 feet. And that was thought to be the primary way that the virus was being transmitted. And as more research was conducted, as we got a better handle on detecting the virus and detecting individuals that were sick, it became more apparent that aerosol transmission was a possibility as well. And the way to distinguish the two is, I read this report, had a really good analogy. If you think about droplets as cannonballs that you're expelling, they travel from your mouth and they're going to fall within 3 to 6 feet. So again, think about a sneeze or a cough. You can see those droplets. But the aerosols are much smaller, like kind of like a vapor, if you will. So if you're talking to someone, it's passed from person to person. And the analogy that I like to use for that is think of someone, cigarette smoke, for example. It's expelled. If you're really close to someone smoking, you can see and you're breathing in the smoke. If you're in a distance from that person in a different room or different floor of your house, you're less likely to get exposed. But with aerosols, and this explains what you, what many of your listeners may have experienced with workplaces and schools, the idea of we need to have good ventilation, is that in certain situations, it was seen that individuals that were in not very well ventilated areas, like certain office spaces early on, gymnasiums early on, elevators, for example, not very well ventilated, the aerosols build up. So if you picture a room where everyone is smoking, the room builds up with smoke, and then the greater likelihood you could breathe in that smoke. Again, not a cigarette smoke, but particles that could contain the virus. So this information is critical because the more we understand how the virus can be transmitted, which is the more likely route, then we can take the appropriate procedures and precautions to mitigate the spread.
What do you think about the possibilities? And I know that some countries, Russia, for instance, has rolled mm-hmm. out a vaccine, perhaps not tested to our liking. What do you think the odds are that this country will see an FDA-approved vaccine hit the stores and hit the streets by early 2021?
My hope is, in following the research that's been published online by the different manufacturers, the vaccines that are being tested, primarily the adenovirus vaccine and the mRNA vaccine that you may have read a lot about, those early on do appear to elicit a good immune response in people, and that's encouraging. So that led on to the other phase two and phase three studies that are currently being enrolled or ongoing that take tens of thousands of people, so it takes time. These are the studies that take time because you have to administer the vaccine, have a placebo group, and then look and wait basically to see if the individuals get infected by the virus and compare the two groups. So it really is, you have to wait this out. There isn't a way to speed up this process. So my hope is that with the information we have on how the body responds to the virus, the ability of these vaccines to elicit that response, that if these larger phases go as planned, that we'll have better information by the end of the year to then allow us to safely and go through the regulations to say, okay, we can release a vaccine. What that vaccine, what the formulation would be, it's too early to tell. Will it be a one shot or two shots? Will it be a one vaccine that fits all populations from children to middle-aged individuals to the elderly? It's not very clear. In terms of, and remind the listeners too, the process is really at a warp speed, if you will. So this process of making a vaccine usually takes decades. So the amount of progress we made thus far is very impressive and a testament to our scientists and our scientific advancement from 1918 to here, if you consider the flu, the early flu pandemic. But it's still going to take time. And my hope, to answer your question, is hopefully by spring or summer, there'll be a vaccine. Now, I should caution too, having the vaccine, someone saying, okay, this is good to go. We should go with this vaccine, building it up to manufacture enough doses to people. What I tell my friends and family members is that there could be a vaccine available, but there's likely to be some kind of process to deliver that. You know, maybe there are certain susceptible populations or certain essential workers that you want to deliver that vaccine to first and then roll it out to the general population. So it's still going to be a very, I think, slow and methodic process before we're all, quote unquote, vaccinated. And that's important in my mind because we want to ensure the vaccine is safe and effective, because if it isn't, it really can do a lot of damage, not just in terms of our ability to fight this virus, but the public perception of vaccines in general.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. We'll get to your calls in a minute. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and we'll get right to the phones here in just a moment here, Dr. Yeager. But one more question from me.
Sure.
And we don't have to go on about this, but here's here's the way my mind works. If all the great minds around the world have been doing double time to come up with a vaccine that works and come up with treatments that work, the common cold is a virus, right?
Right. Yeah. And this virus is you know, kind of like a distant cousin to the common cold.
But why hasn't science as a whole been able to come up with a vaccine for the common cold if we are now theoretically getting close to one for this killer?
Right. I mean, tangentially, maybe the information we're gaining from making a vaccine for COVID might help for that, decades or centuries long battle of the common cold. But a lot of it has to do with what we know about the virus and making the best educated guess as to what part of that or what piece of that virus is going to be important for our immune system to recognize. And in some viruses, it's relatively easy to identify and we can make a vaccine and it works out. And in some cases, all the research we do initially, starting in the test tube, what looks promising, then we start to do the clinical studies, just doesn't pan out for whatever reason. So it could be the biology of the virus. It could be the genetics of our the human genetics and the population. So what seems like it should be a pretty linear process in some cases just kind of has a dead end, unfortunately. But my hope is that this, the COVID is kind of a resurgence in understanding of vaccines and development of new platforms that maybe that common cold will be one day beatable.
All right, let's jump on the phones here. The phone lines are getting loaded up. 800-348-2551. If you want to jump in, a few lines are still open. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Hey, how are you, doctor? I appreciate you being on. I'm going to try and make this fast, but I had a friend that was he's a very heavy set guy. He's about 56 years old. He was on a ventilator for like 3 weeks. And finally, they decided to give him intravenous vitamin C, something like 24,000 milligrams every so often, whatever it was. Anyway, he finally came off it from the intravenous vitamin C. Now, I can't understand why. I know in China they've been using it, and it's been working in China, but they keep holding it back and putting a cover over it. I won't let it out. And there's a couple of other drugs also. I think they gave him one of them at this hospital. And he, after 3 weeks, it's amazing that he lasted 3 weeks with this, on that anyway. But the other thing was, I was just driving cross country and we stopped at a restaurant. And I have a problem with masks, was that I have a post-traumatic stress. And when I wear a mask for too long, I start to get really anxious.
Yeah.
Like I'm being trapped in a corner somewhere. And the other thing is, I spoke to some people sitting at a table wearing a mask before they ate. They still had their mask on. This was in, I think it was Texas.
Okay.
So I started telling them about wearing a mask too long deprives you of oxygen, which is what your body needs to fight off anything. I mean, it's just the way it is. So a woman from another table turns around and says to me that her friend owns a business with 30 employees. And each employee got a letter saying they're going to come and get tested for the virus. So she says, they never came to do the test on these 30 employees. but each employee later on got a letter saying that they tested positive.
Ah, okay. Do you have a question for Dr. Yeager that you might want to formulate here? Howard.
I could probably take some information. So, Howard, okay. Thanks. And first, I'm happy to hear your friend's doing better. Being on a ventilator that long, I know it can be kind of taxing to the body. The idea of using vitamin C and other types of supplements, for example, there is a lot of, I think early on, you know, clinicians are trying to get a handle on anything that would, you know, hopefully help the patient. Because really at that time it was, you know, the patient helping the patient and hopefully getting that patient out of the hospital and back to home. So they tried different things, yeah. but I think the real pause has been what clinicians and scientists look to do is to use evidence-based studies. So what they really have to do, unfortunately, and this is where it takes time, is they would have to have a group of individuals with the same disease, potentially on hopefully on a ventilator with vitamin C and without, and compare the two groups to see, was the vitamin C a benefit? Did it reduce the amount of air pressure they had to use on the ventilator? Did it improve your friend? Was he discharged sooner? Other types of factors. So those studies, they need to kind of get people and groups together to do. So that's the best, again, randomized controlled studies to make sure that what they want to then tell other clinicians is, hey, we have this approach. We have multiple studies to show that it works. We can pick it up. And that, as Ray mentioned beginning of the show, it's been kind of the quandary is that we have these pieces of information where, like, you know, in this patient it seemed to work, this patient it didn't. So it's really you know, kind of vexing to a clinician, I'm sure, to figure out what's the best approach to take for my patient right in front of me. So hopefully more studies are being done looking at vitamin C. In terms of wearing a mask, my sister runs a business where she has to wear a mask the entire day. And she asked the very same question about the, you know, what's the concern about the mask? And I can't remember the study and what journal it came in, but a clinician did a study of all the different types of masks from the N95, which is the most tight fitting. And that does allow airflow to occur. Otherwise, you'd have doctors in the wards passing out.
Yeah.
So you need to have a flow of oxygen and CO2 out. Now, they do make breathing a bit more, let's say, laborious, but it's a little tougher to breathe. You wouldn't wear these running on a treadmill, down to the surgical mask to the cloth masks. So each one, again, the reason why the N95 is most protective is because it has the tighter fit, and the fabric it's made out of protects the individual, and surgical masks a little less so, and then finally the cloth masks. So what we know is that really the cloth masks are important, and I appreciate, you know, I can fully understand and appreciate the, you know, the masks aren't fun to wear, and in some cases there are people that, you know, shouldn't wear a mask for certain conditions. In that case, then it's just different mitigation processes, so social distancing and kind of limiting public interactions until we get a better handle on control, community spread, and development of a vaccine.
Howard, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Jim is in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
Is it true that some corona patients die despite being placed on ventilators due to the virus affecting endothelial cells and blood vessels, causing strokes and embolisms?
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, there's what we've known now, and kind of the other thing that, as Ray mentioned, what do we know now that we didn't know in the beginning was the effects of the virus on the body, and the understanding that early on, it seems like the idea is to treat the virus, and then after that, it's really, in some cases, the body's immune system overreacting potentially and causing damage to the patient. So it's really trying to further understanding, and what doctors did discover is that this virus, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, does induce a lot of clot formation, and in some patients that does lead to additional damage and potentially strokes. Additionally, that's also a concern with individuals that maybe have underlying health conditions such as heart disease or COPD. So the virus does, again, we can't say it's maybe directly related to the virus or the body's response to the virus, but that has been observed, and clinicians and scientists are looking to identify therapies, potentially the use of anticoagulants in certain patients to prevent that from occurring and to improve the survival rate.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences joins us today. Our number on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Nancy is in Middletown. Nancy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me okay?
You betcha.
Yes.
My question is kind of a question/comment. I was wondering if there isn't too much emphasis really on being exposed to the virus as opposed to having people focus more on, especially the medical community, giving more information on how to develop a strong immune system and protecting themselves, not just from corona, but, you know, general viruses like a common cold. It seems to me that we have a Western mentality about depending too much on vaccines and medications and everything instead of using the body's natural defenses and promoting those, you know, increasing a better sleep, increasing more exercise, increasing better nutrition, those kinds of focuses instead of just talking about the disease itself.
So thanks, Nancy, for your comment and question. The idea of exposure really is because we're in the middle of a pandemic and we don't have a good handle and the information is still building on this particular virus. So the idea of limiting exposure, we term a non-pharmaceutical intervention. So things like wearing a mask and staying distant from individuals and looking at yourself for symptoms are things that we can take until we have a better understanding and we do have therapeutics. In terms of building a stronger immune system, I wholeheartedly agree. It's important to be nutritionally sound and get enough rest as much as you can in a stressful time. And definitely that's going to help improve your immune response. Now, the idea of your immune response versus the vaccine, the one kind of theory that's been out there is, well, why can't we just let everyone get sick, let their body deal with it to build up a natural immunity, and we'll get to herd immunity through that. And the trouble with that is with this disease, yes, in certain people, they're at a higher risk, and even if fatality rate is anywhere from 3 to 5%, oh, doesn't that mean that, 90, 97, 95% of people should be fine? Well, the trouble is, think of the entire population. It's a virus that we've never seen before up until this year. People aren't naive to it. So you have a large population that would have to be exposed and develop natural immunity, and then that is going to lead to some people being hospitalized and dying. The other thing we don't fully understand yet is the immune response you generate naturally sufficient to protect you? There's sufficient evidence building that, unfortunately, the antibody response against this virus might be waning over a period of months. That doesn't mean that a person is not protected. Scientists, immunologists are studying T cells and B cells, two important cells in your immune system that are important for protecting you against re-exposure, to see their role in protection long-term against this virus. But we don't yet know enough about the natural immune response to this virus to kind of warrant people to do certain things. So really just the non-pharmaceutical interventions with limiting your exposure and mask wearing. And on top of, as you suggested, you know, good sleep, good nutrition.
Nancy, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today on this Medical Monday, as he does periodically during this continuing pandemic. Dr. Yeager's from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And if you have a question about coronavirus or anything else in his subject of interest, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Peter is in Albany. Peter, you're on.
Hey, thank you so much. It's a great show. I'm really enjoying it. My question is, what if there is no vaccine? There is a vaccine for the flu, but you could still get the flu. There are remedies or ways of bolstering your immune system and things like that, but you can still get those things. And I guess as a second question, I mean, like, what if there's no vaccine? I mean, like, what if there's no vaccine and we have to rely on the morphology of the virus to just kind of change form, and then our own biology to kind of deal with that. And then the second question is, what if what if the virus mutates like viruses do, and it becomes like necessary to develop like yet another, or we have yet another pandemic that creates a comorbidity, like you get the flu and you get COVID, that could be like having diabetes and getting COVID, you know, that could be like a double whammy, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, thanks for your question, Peter. So the idea of a vaccine, like the studies that are going on now, is what's going to be the measurement of an effective vaccine. So you mentioned the flu vaccine, for example, is considered an effective vaccine. Now, its efficacy ranges in some years from anywhere from 30 to 45%. And you might look at that and say, well, is that a really good vaccine or not? And the idea with a vaccine is I wouldn't say impossible because science could prove me wrong, but it's difficult to get a vaccine that's 100% effective. You want a vaccine that protects a certain number in the population, but a vaccine that could also lessen the severity of disease. So that's another kind of milestone for the vaccine developed against COVID-19, is if we could develop one that is able to lessen the severity. So then people aren't hospitalized or not put on ventilators. That could be a success. And you've probably seen some of the news stories in terms of the FDA and other agencies trying to determine what is going to be that efficacy level. So right now their level is 50% protection. Now, in terms of the mutation, the one fortunate thing about this virus compared to influenza is that the data still supports the notion that this virus mutates much slower than a virus like influenza. Influenza mutates rather quickly, and that leads to the need to reformulate the flu vaccine year after year. So if we have a vaccine against COVID-19, we could be in a situation where it protects you enough to lessen the severity of disease, lessens your ability to transmit, and it could potentially be a vaccine that you may have to get yearly or biannually, and that's yet to be seen. So I think that is something we have to, consider, and hopefully kind of part and parcel of vaccine will have better therapy. So if there is an individual that cannot get vaccinated or the vaccine does not work, because vaccines don't work, unfortunately, in all populations equally, so the very young and very old, potentially have therapeutics to treat those people if they contract the disease.
Peter, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Well, we've talked about this before, but you mentioned it, so I'll ask again. Why is it that the flu virus, the common flu, mutates so rapidly, and this version of the coronavirus is relatively stable? Why?
Sure. So I'll use the analogy of a photocopier to explain how the viruses make more copies of themselves. So they both have similar blueprints, an RNA genome, and they use a machinery that allows to make copies of themselves very rapidly inside our own cells. You can remember that viruses they can't do this on their own. They need to infect our cells to get a hold of some of the machinery to make more copies of themselves. So the coronavirus is a very good photocopier. So it's a good brand photocopier. When it copies its genome, by and large, the copy is a duplicate, an exact facsimile of the genome. So there's very less mutations that occur with that virus. And in fact, this virus has machinery that helps to proofread. So it really wants to maintain the fidelity of its blueprint. The flu virus, on the other hand, is kind of a very poor photocopier. It introduces mutations very quickly. And this allows the virus, it's kind of evolved along with us, in a sense, to tolerate these mutations such that we develop an antibody response or a vaccine against it. And then the following year, the virus is just different enough where it may not work as effectively.
Hmm. Okay.
Go ahead. Sure, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you keep going.
And I think it's just, it's parts of, why do different viruses act differently? And it's a great kind of question as to how they've evolved, co-evolved with us, and why some mutate forever quickly to kind of persist in our environment to be a problem year in, year out, where other viruses don't mutate as readily. And we can actually develop ways to, in some cases, eradicate them.
Let's take a quick break. On the other side of the break, I want you to parse for me what this business about convalescent COVID plasma is and why it was in the news and what is the controversy all about. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. We'll take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. We're joined today by Dr. Eric Yeager of Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Right before we went to the break, I mentioned convalescent plasma. What is it? What is the hope for it? And why did one official say, oh, yeah, this is the thing? And then other scientists said, well, now hang on a minute.
Right. So convalescent serum or convalescent plasma is in the, if you want to call it this way, kind of the old toolbox of clinicians and scientists. So what it involves is you are taking plasma. It's a straw-colored fluid that contains antibodies from a patient that was exposed to a disease and has recovered or convalesced from it. So you can take aspects of their immune system, inject it into a person, and hopefully that provides protection. And this is a procedure that's been done since the 19th century for a variety of diseases like diphtheria. The process for if you get bitten by a rabid animal, it uses antibody, similar type of therapy. If you're bitten by a snake and you need to have anti-venom, it's a similar therapy. So it's giving antibodies to an individual, in this case, with convalescent plasma, from a patient that has recovered from disease. And the idea is that those antibodies would afford some level of protection in an individual that's having a severe case of disease. And this type of procedure is called passive immunization because it's short-lived. The person is not protected long-term like a traditional vaccine, but it does afford hopefully some level of protection. Now, this has been tried early on in the pandemic. It was thought that this could be a way for this to work, but to allow this to be tested, scientists and clinicians had to be sure that the plasma was safe to harvest, that it was free of the virus, and that it did contain antibodies that were able to bind to and potentially neutralize the virus. So a number of studies have been tried out. I think that the consternation between this is that there has yet to be a very, even though there's a lot of anecdotal data building up, and the Mayo Clinic did a large study to show that there seemed to be a reduction in fatality rates, is that the data is still developing. And I think the concern was that, do we know enough about this therapy to push it out? And the concern is, if it goes in the news, people think it's the next hydroxychloroquine, that this is going to be the game changer, that we've developed a cure against this disease. And this is simply another approach that may, in certain cases for certain patients, provide a protective effect. But we don't yet know enough about how widely usable it will be.
But I mean, if you've been using this, or science has been using this since the 19th century, clearly it's fairly safe. Why not do it anyway?
In terms of safe, I wouldn't say it's completely safe. So there are a couple of concerns. So first, you are taking a blood product from a person. You want to make sure they're not infected with COVID-19 or any other infectious disease, because you don't want to cause more harm to your patient. Administering the serum itself can cause some issues in terms of the volume. There's a transfusion effect that can happen, I've read, in some patients. So it's not without risk. And early on, there was some concern that perhaps antibodies could, in certain situations, increase the severity of disease. And I think that noise initially, that there was some concern, and this was mainly from experimental studies, that this antibodies could make disease more severe. Mm. I think that noise has dropped a bit. The data suggests it's not as something that could occur that we were initially worried about. I think the long of it is, we have to get enough individuals that have recovered from the disease, collect enough of this plasma, and have enough on hand to give to people. And there's simply not enough to do that. So that's why there's the push of companies to develop monoclonal antibodies, which in a similar aspect is, you're developing a large vat, if you will, of antibodies against the virus. And then you could administer those to people like the elderly, if there's an outbreak in a long-term care facility, or first responders and medical personnel. And again, this is a short-term protection against the disease. It may last a few months. So it doesn't replace a traditional vaccine, mm-hmm. but it does give us some ability to protect, and maybe in some cases treat, patients with severe disease.
You know, you mentioned the noise, and that is such a great way to put it. I assume, as someone who is in this business, you are used to the noise, but I'll bet you're not used to the microscope and the constant blaring, right, brilliant lights that are on you all the time.
I don't know if they're brilliant lights. I don't think I'm that.
No, but not you personally, but as a researcher, as researchers, everything that is said, this might be possible. Oh my gosh, this might be the answer. There is such a microscope. The country has been under a 6-month longitudinal horror and looking for every little bit of good news. So everything is magnified.
Agreed. I agree wholeheartedly with that. It really, for scientists, clinicians, health practitioners, be it a doctor, a pharmacist, anyone that has some information, it's kind of, words matter and information matters. So what I found is the best job I can do is come on a show like yours, which I love to do, and to answer questions, to alleviate some fears, and pass along some information so that people are more informed about what we're dealing with. So that does, you know, lessen some of the outer noise, if you will.
Yeah.
And then I don't mind it. This is what I signed on for. This is why I want to do science. This is why I teach students.
It's great that you're here. I mean, we love the fact that you have taken time over the course of some very crazy times over the last 6 months. All right, a couple of quick emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones with Dr.
Sure.
Eric Yeager. This one came in from Bill in Lake George. And Bill wants to know, any ongoing studies of ACE inhibitors and blockers as a risk factor?
there was some initial concern that anything that would change. So the ACE2, I'll take a step back here. ACE2 is the receptor on cells that allows the virus to get in. So if you think about the virus needing the right key to open a door to get inside the host cell, ACE2 is that ability to get inside our cells. So there's some concern that certain drugs that would alter the expression on ACE2 on our cells could alter an individual's susceptibility. So there was some initial noise again on that. Was there a concern? Should we not administer certain drugs? I haven't kept up as much on that. I do know that the interactions between the virus and the ACE2 is still being looked at, and there could be some potential there that, again, potentially a therapeutic could be developed from that.
All right. And this one's from Bonnie, and then we'll go back to the phones. Bonnie writes, if someone with chronic congestive heart failure has been in lockdown since January, has their immune system become more fragile and vulnerable to not just COVID-19, but other viruses and germs as well?
So there was a report that came out, like people were concerned that, oh, if we're locked down, our immune system is going to crumble to dust. We're exposed to multiple things on a daily basis, from what we eat, what we drink, and unless a person's in a vacuum, they're being exposed to things still. So their immune system is still being exposed. It's still being activated. The important thing is they're not being exposed to the coronavirus. We don't want to take that risk of someone that has a underlying health condition, like a pulmonary condition, to be exposed to this virus that could cause a severe disease in them. So the important thing is for them to kind of sit tight when a vaccine is developed and hopefully shown to be effective in people with underlying health conditions and of a certain age, then that person should be able to come out and resume life as normal.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And Laurel in Pittsfield has been waiting about a half an hour. It's your turn, Laurel. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I live in Pittsfield, but my sister lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's 70 years old. She lives in a high-rise apartment building, and she hasn't been getting out much except to get groceries, so it's getting a bit depressing. She's afraid to go out even for a walk because young people on the street, on the sidewalk, in the parks, joggers, et cetera, aren't wearing any masks there, she says. So she has to pass by them on her walk. She's afraid of picking up the disease in this way. Is there any real risk of exposure in passing by people on the sidewalk? And what could she do to protect herself besides just wearing a mask, staying 6 feet away if possible? How about a face shield? Any other suggestions?
Sure. Thanks, Laurel. Thanks for waiting. So that's one of the kind of the sad side effects of this pandemic. And, you know, my own family members, my mother and grandmother, having them stay indoors. I mean, there is an emotional and psychological toll of being kind of locked inside, not being able to see individuals, see friends, to get out and just breathe in some air. So I think that, with this warmer weather, it's been nice to be able to do that. In terms of transmission, outdoor transmission compared to indoor, the risk is reduced significantly. So it is safe to be outdoors, as long as you're maintaining social distancing, unless the person is coughing or breathing directly on her, the risk is lower. So I think it's in moderation. You know, she feels comfortable like sitting on a patio or a park bench. The chance of getting the disease is lessened in the outdoor because, as we talked about with droplets and aerosols, there's just more space for the air to go. So it's safer than being indoors. In terms of what else to wear, so the mask is preferred because that does. Now, I should also reiterate, the mask wearing that we're having people wear masks is really to protect people from passing it from person to person. So unless you're wearing an N95 or a surgical mask, which are intended to protect the wearer, the other types of masks really are to prevent or reduce the transmission of droplets to individuals. The masks do provide some level of protection, but we're still learning what that level of protection is. So I think a mask is better. The face shield is really intended to, one, block aerosols if you were to cough or sneeze from being spread to someone. And it's also a form of eye protection. So if someone were to cough or sneeze, it would protect those droplets from going in the eyes. So I wouldn't say just a face mask. And in this case, if you've gone to the dentist, you've probably seen your hygienist or dentist wear a face shield and a mask because they're dealing with it, like droplets being produced during the procedure. Out and about, just on a park bench, I don't think it's necessarily useful to wear. So I would say, for her, as much as she feels comfortable, and that's what I tell my own family members, if you go to the grocery store, if you're going out, it's your level of comfort. If you feel nervous, make the call to go back inside. If you see a crowd of people you just don't feel comfortable, walk on the other side of the street. But it is important to get out and get some fresh air before we go back into fall or winter and we're back indoors.
Laurel, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. Catherine is in North Chatham. Catherine, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if having an autoimmune disease makes one more vulnerable to catching the coronavirus. So that's my general question. And then I have a personal question. I do have an autoimmune disease, and specifically Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I'm 70 years old, and I'm getting pressure from my family to babysit my grandson. And my daughter-in-law is expecting a baby in December, and I think I'm going to have to be staying in their house while that's happening, and I'm just petrified. I've been basically in isolation this whole time. So what is my risk? Do I dare?
Right. I think you paint a great picture, Catherine, of what we're all dealing with. And I've kind of thought about this when I've gone out and done things and even coming back to campus. Everything seems to be risk assessment, from going to the store to picking up a coffee to entering a classroom. It's what is the risk? So it can be really stressful. And in terms of autoimmune disorders, scientists have developed, I mean, as we get more data with patients and what their underlying health conditions are, there's a sense for what conditions are most concerning. And in terms of autoimmune disorders, like diabetes is up there. I'm not sure about Hashimoto's thyroiditis particularly. I would recommend maybe checking out the CDC website for that. More of a concern is really if you're on any therapeutic that has kind of the ability of dampening your immune response so it doesn't cause your body to continue to attack its own tissue, there could be some concern there. And I would recommend maybe talking to your clinician and pharmacist to make sure that there's no data out there to suggest that, and probably wouldn't want to change therapies. In terms of babysitting, what we do know right now, and this is kind of on probably everyone's mind with school openings right around the corner, is what is the risk of a child getting sick and transmitting the virus to someone else? And that data is still evolving. But what's clear is that younger children have a lesser incidence of disease and they appear to be less able to pass the infection from person to person up to about age 10. After age 10 and into the teenage years, the individual seems to be more like an adult in their ability to get sick and transmit the virus. So that data is kind of developing. And I think, I don't want to call this a good or sad thing, really, is as kids go back to school, we'll get a sense for really what that true number is. Is that initial understanding that the transmission level is low in young children, is that going to be substantiated, or is it going to be, are all children a risk of transmitting? But right now, what we know is that children under the age of 10, they predominantly don't pass the virus. They can get sick from adults, but they're less able to transmit it.
Catherine, thank you very much. Let's jump over to Sunderland. And Susan, you're on.
Hi. My question is about the way that we need to be processing food that we get at the grocery store. In the beginning, you know, they wanted people wiping everything down with wipes or alcohol or something, and, you know, being really extra careful with produce and, you know, bringing in the newspaper, letting it sit outside for a while till a few hours or whatever. So my question is about how do we need to be thinking about transmission from picking up food at the, you know, not, I hear about the aerosol and, you know, the breathing, but how do we process the food we bring home or the newspaper and mail?
Sure. So there was, and early on, too, there's all the information about how long did the virus live on cardboard, on copper, on every object we could test to see what the concern was. And I'm happy to say there has not, to my knowledge, been a incidence of food-transmitted coronavirus or COVID-19. So the individuals are being infected by aerosols or droplets. Or if there is a contamination, they've touched a surface where someone had sneezed or coughed and then touched their eyes, mouth, or nose. So food, you know, produce you get from the store, I mean, you want to wash anyway if there's any kind of pesticides potentially. But it's no different than, you know, I wouldn't treat it any differently. Really, I would be careful with mostly making sure after you handle things is to wash your hands, follow the proper hand hygiene that the CDC put out, you know, singing the happy birthday song and wash your hands the right way. In terms of getting packages, same thing. When I get mail, and my wife and I get our mail, we wash our hands after handling it. Packages, the same thing. Foods from restaurants that deliver takeout, I still recommend using your own utensils, using your own plate to serve the food. again, there's no evidence that anyone's gotten sick from food directly.
Okay. Susan, thanks a lot. We're about out of time here. We have about 45 seconds, and I apologize. You probably can't give me a solid answer on this. But I just wondered, you know, we've seen the responses from the states, and we've seen New York lower the transmission rate and lower the rates, the new cases. But yet we have 32,000-plus people who have died. Why is it, and how can it be that a state like California that's had 707,000 cases only has about 13,000 recorded deaths?
Yeah, it is. It was terrible to see early on that New York was hit so hard and had suffered so terribly initially in the pandemic. My own personal opinion is I think part of that was just due to the urgency and not knowing really how to best treat patients, being able to diagnose effectively that a patient was infected with COVID and not something else that could be treated differently. So it really was, unfortunately, part of the learning curve about what this virus is, how it's transmitted, and how we can work to the best interest of our patients to make sure they can and be discharged from the hospital. So my hope is that fatality rate stays lower.
All right. Well, Dr. Yeager, we're out of time, man. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you can come back. I hope eventually we won't have a reason for it, but I think we'll probably have a reason for it. So we'll see you soon. Thanks a lot for making time.
You're welcome, Ray. Glad to be with you again.
Talk to you soon. Support comes from Dr. Jean Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Once again, thanks to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for all the great calls. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowitz took the calls. Joe Makowitz is back in the building, and this is reason to celebrate. I'm Ray Graff. Now, tomorrow on the program at 2 p.m., a special episode on suicide prevention, and we hope you join us for that one. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.